So you have these IRAs and Roth programs. Does my will, if my will says my children, does that Roth document have to have their names on it, or does the will cover it? The same way with other little, I think you alluded to it, but I was just about getting lost at that point.
Well spoken. Well spoken.
Yeah, I'll address that question, then I'll address another question that somebody mentioned during the break. And yeah, I'm happy to for you to jump in as we go through if there's something that didn't quite make sense. What I was talking about with the retirement funds or funds, anything that does not have a beneficiary designation, like an IRA, if it does not have a beneficiary designation, meaning there's nobody listed to receive the account, your will does take care of that. It will distribute the account, but it may be and will likely be less tax efficient. Okay, so if your estate is the beneficiary of an IRA, particularly a traditional IRA, or SEP, or simple IRA, anything where the withdrawals are taxable to you, if that has to be paid to an estate because there's no beneficiary, that will be less advantageous from a tax planning standpoint. If it's a Roth IRA, a little bit better, but it does prevent your beneficiaries from continuing to enjoy the advantages of a Roth IRA, which is tax-free growth for a period of time. So it is almost always better, if you can, to have designated beneficiaries of your IRA accounts.
And who would you recommend at our age
to designate
as a beneficiary of an IRA?
Whoever you want the account to go to. And I don't mean that, that's not a cute answer. It's just if spouse is the best, as long as your spouse is living, as the primary beneficiary. And then you have an option to name contingent beneficiaries, which means if my primary, my spouse, let's say, is deceased, these are the beneficiaries that I want to receive it. And that is generally good if you want your children to get the assets that it would go to them. If you are naming a charity as a beneficiary of your estate and you have a traditional IRA or any kind of tax-deferred IRA, there's a planning opportunity there, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. The other thing that was mentioned to me during the break, what's the difference between a revocable living trust and an irrevocable trust, or irrevocable, I don't know, you can say it either way. So a revocable living trust is something that you start while you're living. Generally, you start it and you're the trustee. You can change it or revoke it at any time. It has no tax implications associated with it. It doesn't file its own tax return. You're still the taxpayer. An irrevocable trust means you cannot revoke it, at least not without maybe tax implications or penalties associated with it. So it's a different planning tool. Sometimes it is a charitable type trust. Sometimes somebody's trying to get away from all their money going to a nursing home, or sometimes it's just a variety of things, okay, that you could do with a irrevocable trust that you can't do with a revocable trust. Usually an irrevocable trust is its own tax-paying entity, so you have to file a tax return for it. It's very hard to change if you can change it at all. Some of them you can't ever change. So it's a little bit more, you'll be a little more sure it's what you want before you do it. But it's a little more advanced in terms of what you might want to do with an irrevocable trust. The revocable living trust is a lot more common for your general estate planning needs. As I went through, there's some benefits and downsides, if you will, of the revocable living trust. But a big benefit of the revocable trust is it is revocable. So if you don't like it down the road, you can undo it with no downside other than you wasted a little money on the legal fees. All right, so we're going to move on to the topic that should make everyone's eyes glaze over here, or maybe not. Sometimes we're interested in things that can save us money, but just some basic tax things to be aware of. Ideally, you're working with a planning professional and they can help you navigate these things. Although not every attorney that seems to quite take advantage of all of these the way they should. And if you're not if you're not talking with an attorney or tax planner about certain things, this is for awareness. So a big question on people's minds sometimes with their estate planning is, what does this mean for taxes for me when I die? If you live in Pennsylvania, there is an inheritance tax. If you live in any state, there's federal estate tax. The federal estate tax only applies for estates greater than about $13 million per person. Okay, so you have to have quite a bit in order for that to apply. And if you do have an estate over that size, and you're not going to leave more than that limit there, it changes every year with inflation. If you're not going to leave more than that limit to your children and you're going to have to give the rest to charity, then that's fine. Anything you give to charity doesn't get counted in that exemption allowance. So for most people I deal with, this is not an issue. And probably for most of us here, the federal estate tax is not an issue. The inheritance tax would apply to you if you live in Pennsylvania. The tax basis step up. This is something that is good to be aware of, especially if you're at the stage where you have more properties than you know what to do with, and you're saying, oh, I need to get these properties, or maybe you just have one, but you say, I need to get this property passed on because you don't want to die owning property, right? I mean, we all know that, right? No, I'm just kidding. It's okay if you die owning property, all right? And in fact, from a tax planning standpoint, it's probably much better than trying to pass it on right before you die. The reason for that is, you may have purchased that property a long time ago and you paid a lot less for it than what it's worth today. Or it may be a rental property that you've depreciated, or a farm and you've depreciated all these buildings. If you sold it today, there would be a lot of capital gain tax or depreciation recapture tax. There'd be a big tax bill if you sold this property today. If you gift it to your children, well, then you don't have to pay tax. Well, if you gift it to them before you die, they get the same tax basis you had when you gifted it. Meaning if they turn around and sell it, they'll have a big tax bill. So you've just kicked the can down the road. If you die and you own this property, maybe your tax basis is only $100,000 and it's $1 million property. So you'd have to pay a lot if you sold it the day before you died. If you die and it gets sold the day after you die by your estate, which it would be a few months, let's be realistic, but if it's sold by your estate after you die, that tax basis reset at the time of your death, meaning the new tax basis is whatever it was worth when you died, $1 million. If your estate sells it for $1 million, the tax bill will be zero instead of $200,000 or whatever it would have been if you sold it. Okay, so the tax basis step up is a significant, I don't say loophole because it's not so much a loophole, but it is the way the tax code works. And it hurts sometimes when you hear about clients who had this farm and they say, oh, yeah, I got to get rid of this farm before I die. And they do something with it. And then, you know, and it's time for the heirs to sell it. Now there's a big tax bill. Well, they just didn't know. Okay, so that's why I'm telling you, if you have appreciated assets or heavily depreciated, in other words, you'd sell it for a lot more than your tax basis, there's potentially savings by holding that and passing it through your estate. That's not always practical, all right? Let's not let the tax planning overwhelm the practical considerations of it may be time to pass on that farm. Your son who's taken over the farm may not want to wait another 20 years to be an owner because now he's ready to pass it on. So let's be practical about this. But let's recognize it as it's better rather than quickly try and get rid of these assets before you die. It's okay to pass it through your estate. Let's just make sure that if there's directions about how that needs to happen, that that's contained in your will so that that is handled properly after your death. This also, the basis step up also applies to stock that you may hold. It applies to businesses, basically any asset that you would have a capital gain on if you sold. So just be aware of that. This is back to what we were talking about before with the IRAs. So there are two main types of IRAs. There's traditional IRAs and there's Roth IRAs. There's also SEP and simple IRAs, which are very similar to traditional IRAs. So you have your Roth IRA and then you have everything else, which is the everything else besides the Roth is taxable when you pull it out. The Roth, you didn't get a deduction when you put it in, so it's not taxable when you take it out. If you have a traditional IRA and you would pay tax if you pulled it out, there's no basis step up for traditional IRAs. If your heirs pull that money out, it's all subject to income tax. If it's paid to your estate, it's all subject to income tax. There's no way around that unless you give it to a non-taxable entity like a charity. So if you have these IRAs and you designate a charity as the beneficiary, the charity will not pay any income tax, nor will anyone else, because it's going to this charity. So if it's just a small account, you might just say, well, I'll just designate that to charity, and whatever it is, the charity will get it. Maybe I'll still give some through my estate, or maybe I'll just give whatever's in that account. Or you might say, I want to give 10% of the value of my assets to charity after I die, and then the rest will go on to my children, for example. If you use that IRA to fulfill some of that 10% gift to charity, then your heirs will get the tax-free money and the charity will get the taxable money, but it's not taxable to them. So it completely escapes taxation. So how do...
It would be written in the will.
So if you want to hit a certain percentage of your estate to go to charity and you want your IRA to apply towards that, you will need some provision in your will regarding that. And you will need to make sure your beneficiary designation on the IRA is to the charity. And you will have to look at how much is in the IRA versus how much is supposed to go to charity and is it lining up. If you have $1 million IRA and a $1 million estate, you can't obviously designate all of it to charity unless you want your entire estate to go to charity. But if you have $1 million estate and you have $100,000 IRA and you want 10% to go to charity, you can designate that IRA. Or if it's $50,000, then it'll go and then the estate will make up the difference. Anyway, this is a little bit of a more technical topic, so I'm not going to try to make sure we all understand exactly how it works, other than if you're giving to charity through your estate and you have a traditional IRA and your will does not say anything about the IRA account, then you're probably missing an opportunity for some tax savings there. Okay, so you can talk to your estate planning attorney about that. And hopefully they know what to do with it. And then the last point on here, reducing PA inheritance tax. That's a difficult thing to do. Okay, to avoid and reduce PA inheritance tax is extremely difficult. So difficult that I rarely try, and it's rarely worth trying it. The reason for that is anything that you have access to, rights to, income to, the ability to direct who gets it, anything like that, even if it's not in your name, it's subject to tax. Even if you sold the home place or the farm and you said, you know, I'm selling this to you now, maybe because I don't want to pay tax on it, but I get to live here until I die. I get to use it until I die. Still subject to inheritance tax, even if your name's not on the title because you had the right to use it. So it's a very broad net for PA inheritance tax. There are some exemptions for farms. If the farm is going to stay in the family, you could probably get that exempted from inheritance tax. Just another reason not to sell the farm before you die, if you're okay with waiting. Because if you sell the farm and now your son owes you $1 million, that $1 million IOU is subject to tax. If you owned the farm and then sold it after you died, the farm was not subject to tax. Plus, you probably got the basis step up and avoided capital gains. So anyway, there's a lot of opportunities around planning for farms if it's practical to wait for the sale. So there's an exemption for farms. There's also an exemption for farms even if it's not staying in the family. That one's a lot harder to get, but it is possible. So if you have a farm, there you may be able to exempt some or part of that asset. Family businesses, if the business is going to stay in the family for at least 7 years after your passing, you know, with your children or nephews or siblings carrying on the business, then that can be exempt. Otherwise, you basically have to give it away for it to not be taxed. 4.5% for monies left to children or grandchildren, 12% to siblings, 15% to everyone else is the PA inheritance tax. So 4.5% if it's children or grandchildren, 12% to siblings, 15% to everyone else. 0% to charity. Now, if it's 10 acres, maybe. There's not actually a precise, for this exemption, a precise acreage, but if it's under 10, you're going to have to pretty clearly show like you're doing intensive produce farming or something like that. If it's just back 40 woods, nah. But if you're farming it and it's under 10, probably not if it's 10 or more, because that's the clean and green cutoff. You can have it enrolled in clean and green in Pennsylvania, which is what we're talking about. Maybe. You got to be able to make the argument and sell it to the Department of Revenue, but there is some gray area there. Just like there's some gray area around what's a business, right? Is a rental LLC a business? We think it might be, but we're not totally sure. But giving while you're living. So that is another way to reduce PA inheritance tax. Obviously, if you give it away, you don't have it anymore. And by the way, if you give it away and say, I'm giving it to you, but don't spend it because I may need it back, that is still subject to inheritance tax, all right? If there's this agreement, even if it's verbal, that, hey, if I need it, you got to give it back, that's still subject to inheritance tax. Now, how will they find out? All right, let's not commit fraud as our last act on earth, okay? Let's be honest, people. So you have to give it away at least a year before you die. Anything given away in the year before your death comes back in and is counted. So there's none of this giving it away on your deathbed sort of thing. All right, so that's just some things to be aware of. There's a lot more we can talk about there, but those are some of the kind of big impact items that can resonate with a lot of people. No questions, I'll move on. Blended family situations, or I could have titled this remarriage situations. Sometimes it's not blending family as much as it is looking at a remarriage. Sometimes it's both, both a husband and wife were married before, spouse passed, they both have children, or maybe it's the one was never married before, but the other was. Probably a few remarriage folks in here. So there is a few more considerations here. We already talked about if you remarry, you really need to redo your will, because otherwise it may not actually do what we think it does, because the spouse is automatically included to a certain degree. But when it comes to planning, estate planning around remarriage, there's just an additional level of significance around the planning part of it. Just because there's more facets, there's more room for things to go wrong, there's more people involved, more relational, potential for relational issues if things don't turn out the way people were expecting them. So communication with your spouse, making sure that you get your estate documents updated, communication with children. How things are titled is very important. Sometimes people, when they remarry, they just think, well, we'll just do it the same as I did with my first spouse. We'll own everything together, and that doesn't always work. Okay, sometimes when in a remarriage situation, sometimes you need to own things separately if you want that to go to your children rather than your new spouse when you die. Now, should you leave everything to your new spouse? Maybe, maybe not. Do they need it? You know, we have an obligation to provide for members of our household, all right? That's going back to the verse in Timothy. I think it's a terrible thing if a man remarries and has means and his new wife doesn't have as much or doesn't necessarily have enough to see her through and he doesn't want to give her any. He wants to give it to his children. I think that's a terrible thing. If you're remarrying, I think you're taking responsibility for that person. So when you think carefully about that, that doesn't necessarily mean giving everything outright to the surviving spouse. A lot of times we'll use a spousal trust, and so the money that you eventually want to go to your children, maybe you don't want it to go to the other, you know, your stepchildren, and that's fine. I think that's okay. But you can put it in a spousal trust. It's available for the needs of the surviving spouse, and then when that spouse dies, then it can go back over to your children. So there are ways of doing that. It probably requires thinking about it a little differently than it did with just your first spouse. And we don't need to go into detail because it's not going to apply to the majority here. Just be aware that there are options for being thoughtful in caring for a spouse while also meeting the goal of passing things on to your biological children after your second spouse dies. There's also medical assistance planning issues related to nursing home care, related to mandatory spousal elective share. All I want to say there is in Pennsylvania, there is a program that if you run out of money and you need skilled nursing care, that the state will pick up the tab for that. Whether or not you have an obligation to pay, to expend all of your resources for your second spouse is a topic we could talk about for a while. And I'm not going to weigh an opinion one way or the other, but if somebody feels like they would want to pass on some of their assets to their children, not necessarily pay all the nursing home care costs of their second spouse, then they need to watch out for spousal elective share issues. So sometimes if both spouses come to, spousal elective share is basically the surviving spouse has a right to a certain share of the deceased spouse's estate, even if they're not included in the will. This is different from if you never updated your will after you're married, but it's a similar idea, I guess. And the Department of Human Services can force that to happen even if the surviving spouse doesn't want to. So sometimes remarried spouses will tell me, well, we want to keep our assets separate. We want things to go to our respective children when we die. We don't want necessarily to leave money to each other. And so it may be a good idea to sign a statement just saying that. We're agreeing that we're going to have separate assets, and they're going to pass on to our children on either side, and we're not going to make a spousal elective claim share against each other. That clarifies it for the family, and it clarifies it for DHS, Department of Human Services, and prevents them from coming in and changing that plan. I don't know that banks really are inclined to set up the husband and wife accounts. By that, you would mean they both have to sign any checks from the account? So technically, when we're trying to draw a distinction between the or and the and, by and we're usually meaning this belongs to both and it's set up in a way that both signatures are required. The or implies either one can sign. The and applies both must sign. So I think generally that's a non-issue. I think if you set up an account with your spouse, it's an or account, meaning either can sign and it belongs to the survivor upon your passing. And in a remarriage situation, it's usually good to have an account like that. And that will just go to the survivor. So that's some shared funds that goes to the survivor. You don't have to keep $1 million in there, but enough for living expenses for a while. Anyway, just trying to touch on a few issues. If you have a blended family or a remarriage situation and you haven't given any specific thought to your estate planning around that, it really would be wise to do that. So we're shifting from talking about wills and trusts to other documents, primarily power of attorney documents. So these are documents you need while you're living. Okay, so we already said you only need the will when you die. Before that, it doesn't really do anything except sit there. But there are some things that you may need while you're living, especially if you are incapacitated towards the end of your life. So the main two we'll be talking about is the general durable power of attorney and then the healthcare power of attorney and living will, which those two kind of go together. So the general durable power of attorney allows you to appoint somebody to manage your personal or business affairs if you become incapacitated, or even if you're not. If you just want to go live in Florida and let somebody else manage your stuff, you give them a power of attorney and they're in charge. You can do as much or little as you want if they're willing to take care of things for you. But generally, we're thinking about this in the, I'm at the point where I don't feel competent or I'm just not competent to manage things anymore. The general durable power of attorney gives very broad authority to somebody to manage things for you. It is very broad authority. It's not something you want to give to somebody that you do not trust. And I don't mean just do not trust like they're crooks. I mean like they're going to mismanage or they're going to do things that are going to tick off your other children or whatever. They need to be trustworthy. You need to have a relationship of communication with them so that you can ask them what's going on if you have questions, that you have confidence that they're going to handle things well for you. The power of attorney is effective while you're living. It expires when you die. It's not something that you do for after death. It's something you do if you're incapacitated while you're living. You can name one person, multiple people. Back to what I said about wills, if you name multiple people, they really need to be able to work well together. You don't want power of attorney agents fighting with each other. But other than that, one person's fine, two people's fine, maybe up to three. Don't name more than that unless it's like first, second, third, fourth choice. Often people name their spouse first. If you're incapacitated, you can sign for your spouse, and then you have a couple other options under that. Sometimes people call me and say, I need a power of attorney document so I can work with my dad's bank account. He just has no clue what's going on anymore. He's incapacitated. And I say, I'm sorry, I can't help you. Because if the person is already incapacitated, they can't sign a power of attorney document. I mean, maybe you can grab their hand, but that's fraud, okay? So for a person to make, and maybe I should have said this for a will, to make a will, you need to have a basic understanding of what you have and who you want to give it to, all right? That's about it. For a power of attorney document, you have to understand what you're doing in signing that document. You have to understand you're giving a broad grant of authority to somebody else to manage your affairs for you. If a person does not have that capability and can't understand that and can't pick who they want to be in charge, well, then you can't do that for them if they're not the one that is doing that. So really, when you need that power of attorney, you might already be at the point where you can't legally authorize one. So now, when you're lucid and in your sound mind, now is the time to do it for the future. And some people say, well, boy, that's just really giving them a lot of authority, isn't it? Oh, well, yeah, it is, actually. And so that back to the having confidence in them. Well, boy, I don't know if I'm ready for that. Well, when you need it, it's too late. So we got to do something now. And if you're worried about whoever you're naming getting in there and kind of doing things against your will, then I suggest picking somebody else. Or if you really can't pick anyone else, and you're okay with them once you're not with it anymore, then your two options are you can do a springing, what's called a springing. Instead of immediately effective, it would only come into effect upon your incapacity. I don't really like those because then you have to get a physician's opinion or something like that for it to be activated. So there's more hassle involved there. Or you might be kind of like an in-between state where you're half with it, but you need some help. You're okay, but you need some help. Well, if it's a springing power of attorney, you can't be declared incapacitated if you're not incapacitated. So then you have to do a new document. So I don't really like the springing power of attorney. What I prefer and what I usually suggest for people, if you're not ready to turn over the keys, so to speak, then you can sign this document now. Just keep it with your other important papers. Don't give it to your child. If they don't have the document, they can't do anything with it. Now, They could come steal it out of your home, sure, but you know, if they do that, then you probably just want to revoke it and put somebody else on there. So that's what I usually suggest. Make it effective right away. Put it in the drawer until you're ready. Tell them where it is if something happens to you so that they have access to it. One thing J. Omar alluded to, this document used to include healthcare powers. Back in the day, they more commonly did. Generally speaking, this general durable power of attorney is for financial matters today. And the healthcare matters would be on another document called a healthcare power of attorney. The preferred form today includes both a healthcare power of attorney and a living will. What is a living will? I get a lot of people that ask about a living will, and the way they ask about it, it makes me wonder if they know what it is. So I'll tell you what it is, but usually that's bundled with a healthcare power of attorney, which the healthcare power of attorney is who can make your medical decisions for you when you can't. Who can authorize treatment? Who can tell the doctor to withhold treatment? Here again, you can name one person, multiple people. Generally, I'd say if you name multiple, they should be able to act independently of each other. Same thing for the financial power of attorney. You don't necessarily want your power of attorney agents to both have to sign every check or both be at the hospital. So multiple people is fine. They need to be able to work together even if they're not. They need to be able to cooperate with each other and trust each other that one person takes you to the doctor and makes decisions while they're there, or they can go together if it's something significant. So you can name one or multiple people. Here again, people usually name their spouse and then a couple children, two children, three children. The living will part of this document is addressing end-of-life treatment instructions. I don't know why we call it a living will. I wish there was a different name for it so it wouldn't be confused with your last will and testament. Another term for it is healthcare treatment instructions. That's really, in sum, what this living will is. And it's your wishes about particularly life-prolonging medical treatment, but let's say end-of-life treatment. And the language is usually something to the effect of, if I have an end-stage medical condition that will likely result in my death, despite the introduction or continuation of medical treatment, or I'm permanently unconscious, such as an irreversible coma or a vegetative state, and in either of those cases, there's no realistic hope of recovery, then I direct that. Yeah, I kind of have this language memorized, but anyway, that's usually what it says. That's the statutory language. So if I'm in this condition, now if I'm not in this condition, then I guess this living will doesn't apply. It's really only looking at this end of life. So if I'm in this condition, end stage medical condition, it's likely going to result in my death or some kind of coma, and the doctor does not think I'm going to recover from this, even if I'm treated for it, then I direct that I be given treatment to relieve pain or provide comfort, even if that treatment might shorten my life or suppress my appetite or breathing or be habit forming. That's morphine or narcotic painkillers is what that's referring to. So treatment to relieve pain or provide comfort, up to including the morphine and narcotic painkillers, and I direct that all other life-prolonging procedures be withheld or withdrawn unless there are certain ones that I want to authorize, and there's usually a list there saying, you know, this. You can say, yeah, I do want that. Even if I'm in this end-of-life condition, I still want that. And many people will basically just say, well, if I'm in that condition, I want comfort care, but that's about it. Or some may say, I do want some of these other specific, CPR or ventilator or whatever. So it's up to you. It's you attempting to express your wishes to your healthcare agents and to your doctor about what kind of care you'd like or not in that end-of-life condition. Now, there's lots of other situations. You say, well, what about if I have this or that? Well, that's what your healthcare power of attorney is for. If there's another situation that maybe is not an end-stage condition or a persistent vegetative state, other situations, if you can't make those decisions, that's why you have the healthcare power of attorney. We can't give advanced directives to cover everything because we don't know what's going to come. So you have your healthcare power of attorney, that's broad. You have your living will treatment instructions, which is narrow, only in certain circumstances. Usually those are together in one document, although especially older documents, they might be separated. And then the last thing on here is the PULSED. That stands for Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. That's not something drafted by attorneys. It has to be a doctor that gives that. That's the pink or the orange or whatever, colorful piece of paper that goes on the refrigerator. Some people might wear a bracelet, a DNR bracelet, or something like that. But it's you basically saying, I don't want emergency care of any kind. I have some kind of issue that if I have a heart attack, let me go. Okay, so that's even maybe a step farther than the living will. The living will is saying, if I get to this condition, then this is what I want or don't want. The pulse is saying, if something happens to me, I'm in such bad shape, I don't want to be brought back. Stroke, heart attack, let me go. That requires a doctor's order. And that will apply to emergency medical providers. The living will does not apply to emergency medical providers. So your living will might say, if I have an end-stage condition, I don't want CPR. But if the EMTs show up at a heart attack, you can wave that directive in their face and they're not going to care. Unless you're the healthcare power of attorney, then they might listen to you. But otherwise, that document is not going to, they're not going to be making a judgment about whether you're in an end-stage condition or a coma and that you're never going to recover. The EMTs are not going to be making that. They're going to be doing CPR. So if you get to the place where you don't want emergency services, then the pulse is what you need to accomplish that, which you would talk to your doctor about. Any questions about that? With this document, what to do with it, I suggest giving copies of this to your agents and doctor promptly after it's signed. I say promptly, don't break your head over it, but don't put that in a drawer and say, when you need it, it's in the drawer, because these things happen a bit more suddenly, they can. And so you want your agents to have that on hand, you want your care provider to have that on hand. The other documents, as long as the agents or the executors know where to find it, that usually works okay, because it's a non-urgent situation usually.
You're talking about both of these,
The healthcare power of attorney and living will should be distributed to your healthcare power of attorney agents and your doctor sooner rather than later. That way it's readily available and we're not digging around in drawers while somebody is, in the hospital needing intervention. I think that's fair to say, at least in the context of if they have a pulse, sometimes we call that a DNR. So if they have a pulse that says, do not resuscitate me, and there's a heart attack, then I don't see why you could be accused of not dialing 911. Because if you dial 911, the EMTs are going to show up, but they're going to see the pulse, and they're going to be like, well, I can't do anything. So what's the point? But it is not specifically for protection for those who maybe would be calling 911. Maybe they're in the hospital for a procedure, or they're in the hospital for whatever, and they code, meaning they have a heart attack or whatever. So then in the hospital as well, they would just say, well, they have a DNR, so we're not going to try to bring them back. So whatever the situation is, it's alerting the care providers that you're not supposed to try to resuscitate this person. So if they have a pulse that says do not resuscitate, it usually is a little more specific. It would probably say in the event of a heart attack, do not resuscitate. So they wouldn't do anything for you, or they would not do CPR. They want to know what your wishes would be if you're unable to communicate and you end up in that condition. And probably by living will, they're sort of referring to healthcare power of attorney. Who can we call if something goes wrong and we need to know what to do next in terms of do we give treatment or not? So the living will is generally going to include this concept of healthcare power of attorney. Otherwise, it'd be a good point. Why do they care about that if I'm just going in for a procedure? I'm not.
And even though these are official documents, these you can photocopy?
Yeah, actually, the durable power of attorney you can photocopy as well. Most banks pretend they don't know that, but you can actually do that. The statute says you can. And certainly the health care you can. Yeah. Other questions here? I've got one more slide.
What not to do to us?
Okay, so question is, you have a card in your wallet. We'll just say it's a generic something that came from somewhere about emergency contact information. So if you find this person, who do you call? That has no bearing on healthcare power of attorney authorization. So the person might call this person, your emergency contact, and say, hey, we found so-and-so laying on the sidewalk. Well, they can quickly go and be there, but if the question is medical treatment, then the person who the emergency contact is hopefully knows who the medical power of attorney is and has to get them involved. Probably, yeah, if you can, because that would be the main emergency reason or reason for the call is a medical emergency. Not if, you know, maybe you lost your purse, so they're calling to say, I found your purse, which I guess would be fine too if it's a healthcare person. All right, I'll move on to the last slide here. So this is maybe less technical, more awareness. So we talked about wills, talked about trust, talked about durable financial power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney. These are some other things just to think about. They may apply to you, they may not. But other issues that can arise. So sometimes, depending on the dynamics of the estate, the situation, having family meetings to discuss these things is important. There's kind of a perception, perspective that is sometimes out there that a will is kind of private. Like, don't peek at my will, right? Like, this is me and my wife, and then nobody else should be looking at this. I mean, maybe, but I think that if you're looking for family harmony, the worst thing you can do is keep everyone in suspense until you die, and then there it is, and you know, deal with it. If there are, now if you have simple assets or everything's going to be sold and divided equally to the children, you know, who cares? That's probably what they expect, or they certainly shouldn't be surprised or upset about it, unless they were promised something else. But if you have a family farm that you're planning for and there's a big, you know, discount being given to a certain child to buy this farm or business or something, that might be a surprise to some of the children. And it's better to get that dealt with on the front end. So especially dealing with family farms, discounted sales of any asset really through your estate, to share that with your children. And how do you feel about that? You know, is this okay? Do you have any concerns? And it gives them a chance to say, well, yeah, I kind of have a problem with that. And maybe they just have to learn to be okay with it. But having some of that dialogue and them hearing from you and you hearing from them, and most children are very, whatever you want, mom and dad, while you're living. Now, not all are, but once mom and dad are gone, all of a sudden that tune changes. So if they've already had a chance to kind of interact with this idea while you were still living, it can be a little easier. So if there's some tension already, maybe you even want a third party there to kind of help facilitate the communication and the planning of things. Those sorts of things, while maybe awkward, can go a long way in retaining family relational glue after your passing. And so think about that if your estate has anything unique or it's something other than just selling the assets and dividing them equally. Personal property items like household goods and things, you might want to give some direction for that. When I write a will, I usually say I might leave a memo leaving some instructions about personal items, and that allows you to write some specific things to be given to specific children if you want to. Or just any kind of directives. Sometimes you won't have any, but if there are some unique items that you really think ought to go to a certain way or be handled in a certain way, that can go along. Mom and dad's wishes can go a long way in helping the children get through some of those difficult decisions. If you have any loans to children, if you made any advancements, would be like, I'm giving you money now and you're going to get less later. Mainly just document those things. If you have loans to children and it's just verbal, it really ought to be written down with the terms associated with it, just so there's not misunderstanding or mistrust with the family about, you know, what were the terms of that loan or that kind of thing. I mean, if you did a zero interest loan and the child hasn't paid anything on it in 10 years and now it's time to settle the estate, the other children might say, well, shouldn't there be some interest with this loan? Especially in today's world, right? Interest is going up. And the child, well, no, dad said that's interest free. Well, you know, if it's on paper, that is no problem. If it's just, you know, that's what dad told me, maybe there's no problem or maybe there is. Caregiver agreements, shared housing agreements, medical assistance planning, especially caregiver agreements and shared housing. If you're going to be living with your children, they're providing housing for you, they're providing care, just be as clear as possible and set as many expectations and clarify expectations as much as possible so that there's not misunderstandings or issues with the other children about, well, I was expecting to get something extra for the time I spent caring for mom and dad, or, you know, they put $100,000 into renovating this house so they could live here, and I didn't think I was supposed to pay that back, and just whatever these situations are, with my wife's family, even just the, while you're living, that your relationship with your children, expectations about who's responsible for what, if you're going to kind of live together. That can work so well, you know, to be able to spend your last years with children. But if you don't have a clear agreement about some of the, especially the financial ramifications of that, that can become a real source of contention, even with you and your children or with your children after your passing. Digital assets, if you're the type of person that has a lot of accounts and passwords and a computer that has a password and, you know, if all of a sudden nobody has access to these things, is there going to be a problem? And if the answer is yes, then you really ought to come up with some way of giving access to children, whether that's a password manager or a list of things, lists of information, hopefully in a way that if the wrong person gets their hands on it, it's, you know, that there's some information that you leave off and store in there, they give them to them verbally or something. I don't know. You don't want to just make a list of all your usernames and passwords and start handing them out to your children, because, you know, if the wrong person gets a hold of that, that's a security issue. But a plan for passing on access to digital assets, or accounts, let's say, which could be your photo album online or your online music or your, you know, whatever. If you purchase things, these are digital assets you can pass on, or just access to accounts. And then a letter of instruction, if there are things you want to give specific direction to, funeral arrangements, information that'd be helpful to your executors, final words of blessing or admonition. Those are things that don't really belong in any of the legal documents, but you may want to leave that with your legal documents and pass on some specific words that way. All right, I'm up against my time. Is there questions that anyone would have for me before I sit down?
Quick question on inheritance tax. Is that the state that you live in or the state that the money is coming from?
For Pennsylvania,
inheritance comes out of Pennsylvania to me in West Virginia.
For Pennsylvania, it's based on the state of the decedent, the person who died, and any money or personal property items, if you're residing in Pennsylvania, wherever that money is located, doesn't matter, it's taxable in Pennsylvania, regardless of where the beneficiary is. If it's real estate outside of Pennsylvania, then it would not be taxable. Unless it's owned in an LLC, then it might be. But yeah, it is not at all driven by where the beneficiary lives. Okay, usually it's a little risky to ask questions this close to lunch, so if you're reluctant to do that, I understand. Thanks for your attention and your engagement. I'll just mention, so I put some cards and a couple of folders. The folders contain an estate planning questionnaire. If you're interested in services to update your will or that kind of thing, take one of those. If you're not, it's not going to do anything for you. All right, it's not general information that's applicable to you. It's a questionnaire if you're looking for estate planning services. I didn't bring on just a whole bunch. If there's none left back there, take a card and call or email. We'll be glad to send one out for you.